WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Fail fast, fail often, goes the saying, and nowhere has that mantra been more pervasive than in Silicon Valley, where failure is preached as a recipe for success. Here's Apple's founder and former CEO, Steve Jobs, in 1994.
You got to act, and you've got to be willing to fail. You've got to be willing to crash and burn, you know, with people on the phone, with starting a company, with whatever. If you're afraid of failing, you won't get very far.
We are told that embracing failure, whether it's in business or in our personal lives, is supposed to lead us to sustained success as long as it teaches you a lesson. Failure has almost become a badge of honor. But should we believe all the hype, or is it more complicated than that? This hour, On Point, what's so great about failure anyway? You can join us on air or online. Do we glorify failure? And how do you know when to persist at something and when to quit? How do you know when you have failed? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Peg Streep. She's a writer for Psychology Today and the author of Quitting, Why We Fear It, and Why We Shouldn't. My voice just failed, and I'm going to slurp some water. Excuse me. Peg, thanks for your patience. I want to finish reading the title of your book, Quitting, Why We Fear It and Why We Shouldn't in Life, Love, and Work. Peg Streep, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John.
Thanks for your patience. A colleague before the program said, is this going to be a depressing hour? I said, no, it's going to be interesting. So I don't want to fail at that. So I want to put to you the question that we were putting to our listeners. Do we glorify failure?
Absolutely. Americans love a come-from-behind story, whether it's Rocky the Fighter or anyone else. And it's a cultural trope that we have, right? Winners never quit. Quitters never win. And it's part of our psychological immune system as well. We like to believe that, in fact, failure teaches us something always. Truth is, it doesn't.
So have you thought about how we tell the difference between when something that we've got our hearts set on is going to work out and at least could work out and we should keep going for it, or when it's time to fold them and walk away?
Well, here's the problem, and this is really the problem with the cultural mythologies. Human beings are actually hardwired to persist. It's the default setting. Now, if you think about it, that makes total sense. Because at the beginning, think Paleolithic here, you're a hunter and you need to bag caribou. Mm-hmm. And so you miss said caribou. Well, from an evolutionary point of view, the last thing you want is the human being to crawl back into his cave and say, I give up. So, in fact, the caribou hunter says to himself, no, no, if I just hone my skills a bit, if I sit in a different place as the deer goes by, et cetera, et cetera. So, in fact, it's still true that persistence in physical pursuits, and also, as it happens, test taking, tends to pay off.
So if it's evolutionary, then you're saying the rule of survival of the fittest means survival of the winners, and that the failures have been bred out of our DNA.
No, what I'm saying is that we have all these habits of mind as a result of persistence being the default position. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you don't get something, right? You miss something. You're playing baseball. You miss an opportunity. Your head starts thinking about not the fact that you failed, but how close you got to winning what you wanted. So we see failure often as a near win. That, of course, is exactly what keeps people at slot machines. You know, they have X number of lemons or whatever fruit it is up, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And there are only two that don't match. Now, of course, that's completely meaningless. It doesn't increase your chances of having them all match the next time. Mm-hmm. But our brains actually translate that information from a miss into a near win. And we do it all the time. The other problem, of course, is that human beings tend to be not only overly optimistic about the future, but they also aren't very good at judging how good their skill set is. So add in persistence, add in the fact that we may not really have a bead on how, whether or not we have the skills to achieve a certain goal. And then, of course, the thing that's now left is human beings are conservative and not politically. They don't like the unknown. Mm-hmm. They will stay where they are as, again, a default position, even if where they are is making them miserable and isn't working. And in fact, the way we think about things, and if you think about it for a second, you'll see that. You're unhappy where you are. You're in a relationship. You're in a neighborhood. You're in a job. Your first thought is, wait a minute, I've invested 5 years. If I leave, those 5 years are gone. I mean, mind you, this thinking also applies to, you know, clunker cars and other bad investments, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's called the sunk loss fallacy. Sunk cost fallacy. Anyway, of course, your head is saying investment, investment, investment. So you're staying put. You're trying again. When the reality of it is that most of the time you should be thinking not of the time that you've invested or the money or the energy, because guess what? You're not getting that back.
Well, let's listen to some Peg Streetup, some messages from the culture. And we had no trouble finding messages from this one, something that Oprah Winfrey said in an interview at Stanford Graduate School of Business in 2014.
There are no wrong paths. There are none. There's no such thing as failure, really. So you get as much from your losses as you do from your victories, because the losses are there to wake you up.
And here's another one from a commencement address to Ohio University in 2013, President Obama.
If you are living your life to the fullest, you will fail. You will stumble. You will screw up. You will fall down. But it will make you stronger. You'll get it right the next time. Or the time after that. Or the time after that.
So we're all familiar, Pig Streep, with that. Both of those messages, that failure is inevitable, and the most important part, that failure makes you stronger. And the president went on to say, you will get it right next time, or the time after that, or the time after that. Is that true? Do people always ultimately get it right if they keep trying?
Short answer, no. And that also has to do with a habit of mind. And I think most people will acknowledge this quietly, if not wanting to say it out loud. When we fail at things, we tend not to attribute it to our personal failures, but to something outside, something that we could not control. It's only at those moments in time when we actually take it personally, as it were, don't attribute the failure to something external, and say to ourselves, well, wait a minute. Maybe I don't have the chops to get this done. Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't have the skill. Maybe I don't have the personality. And personality, by the way, also factors into this. Psychologists talk about one way of looking at temperament as people who are largely motivated by approach goals or avoidance goals. Now, someone who's motivated by approach goals sees that mountain, is going to climb it for sure, and knows going in that the likelihood of slipping and or falling is great. He or she is prepared to roll with that mistake and to pick him or herself up. But people who are motivated by avoidance see the landscape of life as one where mistakes are to be avoided at all costs. They tend to be much more cautious. And in fact, when they fail or take a wrong turn, they go down for the count. They're not able to manage the negative emotion that goes with failing or a setback. So, you know, it's pretty to think that every lousy experience, in fact, is going to be an inspirational meme for everybody. But it's not true.
So what do you counsel? What do you count are there times when we should just quit? Should we give up?
Well, again, what you really have to think about is what quitting entails. The word quit has a very negative connotation in our culture. You know, when we say he's or she's a quitter, we mean someone who's a slacker, doesn't put in the effort, right? Leaves the pieces for other people to pick up. But the reality of it is that, and again, remember that we are hardwired to keep going, to persist. What is called goal disengagement, the ability actually to stop persisting because you have realized that your chances of success are small, that you will never make the relationship any better than it is today, that your working conditions aren't going to change. Goal disengagement, unlike the word quit summons up, I'm out of here and the door is slamming, right?
Yeah.
Cut it.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are testing the claim that failure is the key to success. With me is Peg Streep. She is author of Quitting, Why We Fear It, and Why We Shouldn't in Life, Love, and Work. Joining us now also from Portland, Maine, is Harvard Business School Leadership and Management Professor Amy Edmondson. She studies why businesses fail and how to learn from failure. Amy Edmondson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John.
So, Amy, I just mentioned are there ways to learn from failure and ways not to? And I know you apply this to business, but can you always make something out of failure? And if you don't, is it always a missed opportunity?
That's a big question. Earlier, you asked, is it more complicated than that? And yes, it's more complicated than that. I think part of the challenge here is we talk about failure in a very encompassing way and not a nuanced way. So the truth is there are different kinds of failure, and some failure is bad, and some failure is indeed very good, and some failure is merely inevitable, or at least in some context, failure is inevitable. So we need to have this conversation with a very clear understanding of differences in context, differences in failure's cause, and also, of course, differences in the size or magnitude of a failure. So I look at failures of all kinds inside organizations. That might be a very small and ultimately, thankfully, inconsequential medication error to a hospitalized patient, or it might be the launch of a major new product that absolutely falls flat on its face. Both of those are organizational failures. One is small, complex. One is large, has some degree of uncertainty, and there's a great deal of context in between there. And so in order to learn effectively from failure, we need to have a more nuanced conversation about type of failure and the context for the failure. And then we need to be – I think Peg is right. We tend to shy away from it. We don't get failure's lessons. They are – there are psychological adversive consequences of looking directly at our own failures. We're not good at it. Often we need help from colleagues, from friends to take a close look. And there's always lessons there.
Well, I do hear what you're saying, and you're asking for nuance, and justifiably so. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to put that up against the slogans that we hear about failing. We put together a little bit of a list. We've already used fail fast, fail early, fail often. Message, it's great to fail. Number two, failure is not an option. Message, it's terrible to fail. Number three, winners never quit. Quitters never run. Once again, you can only try, and to not try is bad. Number four, if you're not failing, you're not trying. Number five, those who fail to prepare are preparing to fail. What do you make of the bluntness of these messages? Is there any value in that message of never give up, and if you do, there's something wrong with you?
Of course, again, it depends on context. So Never give up. So Jean Krantz, that I think that wonderful in the Apollo 13 case, right, where Jean Krantz basically almost makes that line famous of failure is not an option. Mm-hmm. Well, the fact is we've just had a significant failure.
Oh, good point.
The oxygen tank has has exploded, right? So the fact is we've failed. We have a failure. And his line, which is failure is not an option, means we're going to do whatever we can to innovate on the fly. We're going to put our heads together. We're going to come up with something that's never been done before to rescue these astronauts. And so he is saying failure in the grand scheme, in the end of this story, is not an option. And it is absolutely true that we will not have that ultimate success unless we're willing to tolerate small failures right around right now in essentially the laboratory. So go for it, Tiger Team. Make it happen. Come up with whatever you can. Don't expect it to succeed the first time. You know, the very first foray into this problem-solving mission, they're not going to get it right. There's no way the first solution will work. The second solution may not work. The third may not work. So we're going to persist until there's no chance to persist anymore. But we're going to have to tolerate the small failures along the way. Another brilliant example of that was the 2010 Chilean mining rescue. The mission failed many times a day in their small attempts to find things that would work to get through 750 meters of rock harder than granite. If they had given up, we wouldn't have had this remarkable success. So they had to tolerate the small failures along the way and learn fast from them in order to have the big success at the end. So those are the kinds of conditions where you say and mean it, failure is not an option.
I have to thank you. That was extremely elucidating and a very good explanation of why this is a nuanced conversation, should be a nuanced conversation. Let's listen to a successful person talk about how wonderful failure is. In her 2008 commencement address at Harvard, J.K. Rowling, said that failure gave her the freedom to pursue her life's work, which was writing. She went on, of course, to write the Harry Potter series in the best-selling book series in history.
Failure meant a stripping away of the inessential. I stopped pretending to myself that I was anything other than what I was and began to direct all my energy into finishing the only work that mattered to me. Had I really succeeded at anything else, I might never have found the determination to succeed in the one arena where I believed I truly belonged. I was set free.
So, Peg Streep, back to you. As I said at the beginning, J.K. Rowling is yet one more person who has succeeded after failing, talking about how important failure was. And the reason I mention that is we hear and we have Steve Jobs. And what we're not hearing from is Bill Smith or, you know, Melinda Jones out there who's failed and failed and failed, let's say at art or business or sports or whatever it is, who hasn't hit it big yet. And we're not hearing that person talk about how wonderful failure is. And it strikes me that we only hear the successful talk about the greatness of failure.
Oh, absolutely. But again, what J.K. Rowling said was a little bit more complicated than that, because she said that what changed her was the determination to take stock. She took stock, and she knew that if she didn't go for it, nothing was going to work. Now, in part, because, as I said, persistence is hardwired into us, really successful people need the ability to let go of a path that isn't working for them. Two homey examples, and I think most people will identify with this. You're in a terrible relationship. Could be a friendship. It could be a marriage. You can't get out. You stay. You do everything you can. And finally, in a moment of total exasperation and anger, you walk out the door. Of course, then what happens is you've walked out the door, but you've taken all this emotional baggage with you. So you go on your first date with someone new, and you're really excited. And what do you talk about? You talk about your ex. People do the same thing when they... Everybody knows that the one thing you're not supposed to do in a job interview is talk about how lousy your last job was mm-hmm. and how dreadful your boss is. But if you've quit in a rush, if you've quit because you finally just can't stand it anymore, then you haven't really quit. You haven't really let go. You've walked through that door with all those bags. And that, of course, dooms you pretty much to failure again. And it doesn't permit you to learn anything from the experience because you have to leave in a certain way, quit in a certain way, so that you're able to manage your thoughts about what's happened, manage your emotions so that you're not pacing in the middle of the night. You have to deal with the free fall of having left. And then, here's the big one, you got to figure out where you're going next and whether or not you have the capacity to go where you need to go. It's at that moment, by the way, that indeed quitting opens up a new path and a possibility of a lesson.
We have a lot of comments coming in on our website and via Twitter. Mark writes in, one lesson we're trying to impart to our kids is that there are times when failing matters more than others. At this point in their lives, ages 9, 7, and 5, there aren't many critical decisions or situations they face for which failure can have life-changing effects. Will it really matter if they can't master that piano exercise right away? No. Does it really matter if they screw up while making the chocolate chip cookies? No. Do they have to score a goal every time they play soccer? No. We're trying to make sure our kids can keep, he says, we're trying to make sure our kids can keep things in perspective and learn about responsibility and accountability. And let's bring in Melanie from Oklahoma City. Melanie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I really like this subject. It's actually one that I use a lot when I talk to some of the offenders that I work with in reintegrating them into society.
Oh, interesting.
One of the things that we talk about is failure and how to use that as part of your success in the future. But I often warn them to be careful because sometimes we get so hung up on failure as glorious that people can become complacent in that, in a sense. It's almost like saying, no one's perfect. Well, that might have been soothing and encouraging at one point, but now it's almost an excuse to not try harder.
Do you really see that happening? People embrace failure not to succeed, but they embrace failure in order to fail?
As an excuse for their failures, as opposed to learning from the failure and making it, turning it into something that they can use for their success in the future,
so,
they simply say, oh, it was a failure.
As their counselor, what do you come back with when you see that happening?
I encourage them to look at their own actions in the situations, not to dismiss their failure for somebody else's part in the whole ordeal. Don't attribute your failure to them. Examine yourself. See what you can do differently in the future so that you are successful the next time.
All right, Melanie, thanks very much for your call and interesting, interesting insight. And let's go to Sam. He's calling from Detroit. Sam, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
So you have these nuanced and various definitions of failure. In light of that, can you describe a general set of attributes of the business manager or the entrepreneur that actually succeeds in the aftermath of failure?
And why they're not quitters, you mean?
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
Obviously some people quit because they don't have a skill set, but other people don't. But I'm sure some people develop a skill set.
All right, let's take that to Amy Edmondson, since she does this from the business point of view and you've asked about entrepreneurs. What about that, Amy? Is there a type?
Absolutely. Yes, well, it's a terrific question, and I want to take it one step back. So you asked whether there are things to do to learn. Let's step back to in advance of any new enterprise or action, I think you have to ask yourself several questions. First, is the opportunity here significant, right? Is the upside potentially significant? Because if not, you know, why bother wasting your time failing in it, right? Second, will the outcome of this action, whatever it is, be informative? In other words, if the outcome's already known in advance or knowable in advance to be one that won't work, skip it, right? So we should only be having what I like to call new failures. Third, you know, is the cost and scope relatively small? Don't bet the farm on something completely uncertain and unknowable. Next, have you articulated to yourself and out loud the key assumptions that will be tested? And will the plan test those assumptions? And so in a sense, what we're trying to do is before we have the failure, make sure it's going to be a smart one. Make sure it's going to be one from which we could learn. We could either succeed or we could learn. And then let's assume we've gone forward with all of those. We've failed. Now we have a very specific terrain of things to look into of, okay, where was our assumption wrong? How could we have done it differently that might have received a different outcome and so on? So then we're in a good position to take that knowledge and use it not to quit but to pivot, right, to try something different in what we've already at least articulated might be a very significant opportunity.
Let's bring in Sean from Raleigh, North Carolina. Sean, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
That's a pleasure.
So, fascinating topic. And as someone who's been in journalism and marketing and also a singer-songwriter, I've experienced what some would sort of describe as successes and failures in all fronts of creative pursuits. But my general question is kind of layered. So is there, or would you sort of say, and this is the guess as well, is there kind of a standardized description of failure in the sense of you've got the Einstein comment of insanity is you do the same thing over and over again. And in some sense, if you're failing and you keep trying and you keep failing, that sort of falls in line with that. But also, if it is subjective, then you have one person saying, I failed, and other people saying, I succeeded, in the same way happiness is subjective.
That's so interesting.
I would love to hear your perspective on that.
That's so interesting. Sean, thanks for that question. I'm going to take it to Peg Streep. Is one person's failure another person's success, or at least neutral result?
Absolutely. I mean, people make different choices for themselves. And it all comes down to how happy you feel with the outcome. I mean, that is, people have different levels of expectations. And people define themselves, again, people define themselves in different ways. For some people, definition of self is very highly centered. That is, someone who defines him or herself primarily through work. The work of Patricia Linville, who's a psychologist, showed that, in fact, people cope with bad things, failures, setbacks, with greater skill if they have more varied definitions of self. So when, you know, someone fails at becoming a songwriter or a marriage implodes, right? Why is it that one person says, okay, I'll do something else, I'll try again, and the other person goes down for the count? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with not only personal definitions of happiness, but definition of the self. So that somebody who defines him or herself by lots of things, not just manager at a company, but manager of a company, hobbyist golfer, woodworker, father, brother,
son. It gets very complex. Well, Peg Streep, but one thing we haven't talked about yet is what happens with fear of failure as opposed to failure. And we're going to be talking about that when we come back with a writer who has focused a lot on that thought. But for now, Amy Edmondson and Peg Streep, stay with us. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
For my advice to anybody that wants to quit, it'll feel much better if you say it like this.
Take this job and shove it.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
Spouse, what happened to where you are, so they can come and get you in the car later on and help you search for a new 9-to-5 job.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking about the hype surrounding our fail-fast culture. We are talking with Peg Streep. She's the author of Quitting, Why We Fear It and Why We Shouldn't in Life, Love, and Work, and Amy Edmondson, a professor of leadership and management at Harvard Business School. Now, I'd also like to bring into the conversation at this point from NPR West in Culver City, California, Ashley Merriman. She's a journalist who writes about human behavior and motivation. She co-authored Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing with Poe Bronson. Welcome to On Point, Ashley.
Thanks for having me.
Have you been following the conversation?
I have.
You got any pushback? What do you think?
I absolutely do. First of all, yes, we need to actually meaningfully examine our failures. And you can't just assume just because I failed, I've learned from it. But the research has found we learn even less from success. In a failure, it's a natural process to say, what did I do wrong? Now, you may say, I didn't do anything. It was the other guy's fault. Mm-hmm. But there's still a trigger in terms of that reflective moment. We don't take apart our successes. We don't realize that sometimes we were successful just because of dumb luck. And we rely on that success to continue in the same way we did. So the first thing, the value of failure, is that moment when you are thinking, what have I done wrong? What could I do differently? And it rarely happens for the success. It's great when it does, but it's not a common process.
So you're making a bit of an argument for how great failure is then, that it teaches more than success does.
Absolutely. I think, and again, it's not that it's a slam dunk, but that's the reason people keep talking about how failure is a benefit. It's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because people want you to have that experience of learning from your mistakes. And we just don't learn from our successes. You've asked a couple times. We only hear about learning from failure from successes.
Right.
I've asked the success story. Well, your first.com, you sold for $1 billion. What'd you learn from that? Nothing. I learned when I, it plummeted the next time.
Well, do you like me ever listen to the successes talking about the wonders of failure and ask yourself where that person would be at that moment on the whole subject of failure had he or she not had the ultimate success?
I do, but there's actually researchers who've interviewed titans of business, gold medalists, and the gold medalists at the Olympics say, the reason I won is because I didn't even make the team last time. Mm-hmm. And I realized I'm going to do everything I possibly can to make it this time. And when I get there, it's going to count.
What is the impact of fear of failing on people's ability to take action?
Well, again, I think this is a little bit of a pushback from the earlier conversation. Yes, we're hardwired to persist, but we're also hardwired to avoid danger, right? Mm-hmm. If, on the savannah, yeah, you might have been trying to hunt or fight off, but if that tiger was going to take you, the researchers talk about this as the threat state, and you are physiologically tightening up, your heart rate variability is dropping, mm-hmm. your blood vessels are constricting, and you want to just survive. So we're constantly having this question before we start, are we going to be successful? And if we think we're not, then we don't do it. So fear of failure can be incapacitating. Researchers asked young people in the UK, what's your dream job? What would you love to do? And they said, oh, I want to run my own business. I said, are you going to? No, because I think I would fail. And they don't even want to try because mm-hmm. they're so worried that they know they're doomed from even the beginning.
Interesting perspective on the whole question. Let's bring in Leonard from Belmont, Massachusetts. Leonard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I'm concerned about the message that may be heard or misheard, for example, by children hitting a problem in school. Now, there's some research that shows a big difference between Asian immigrant parents and American parents is that the Asian parents are likely to tell their kids, you've got to work harder if the kid has a problem. American parents are more likely to say, well, you're just not smart enough. Or the American kids get the message, I'm not smart enough. I should not learn arithmetic, but aim instead at being a rock star or whatever. So I just would like I would like that to be addressed and for the kids listening to know that they shouldn't get the message that they should give up on learning arithmetic.
I'll also want them to get the message right away that it's not that easy to become a rock star either. But let's take that question to Peg Streep.
Well, again, we're really talking not about telling children that they should simply quit when they don't feel like it, or because it's hard, or because they're not succeeding. I mean, that's really not what the conversation is about. And obviously, as parents, it's tricky allowing a child to quit an activity, particularly if it's a group activity. There are lessons there. But on the other hand, you know, the reality of it is I took 3 years of piano lessons, and I'm the least musical person in the history of the world, and I could have taken 30 years of piano lessons, and it was a complete waste of time. I should have been doing something else. So I think in terms of parenting, we're really not talking about quitting in the sense that we're talking about being able to leave something behind fruitfully as an adult, being able to manage your emotions. And I agree in the sense that it's true enough. Happiness and success do not require self-examination. That's why, as famously an article put it, bad things are stronger than good.
Let me take Leonard's question. I just want to take Leonard's question while we're still thinking about what he said to Ashley Merriman about the impact on kids and whether, you know, should kids who just aren't doing well be told at some point give up? Or, you know, and should they know at a young age that there are winners and losers and there are good things and bad things and that maybe they're not one of the winners?
Well, Leonard's question was a great one. And actually, it was Flory Eng's research that he was talking about the University of Chicago. And the difference primarily between the Asian American parents and the Asian parents in Taiwan, where she did the study, and American parents was that the Asian families were focused on a skill set and things that were under your control, effort, studying the technical abilities, whereas the American parents were focused on these sort of global traits. You're special, you're smart, you're talented, or you're not. And when we're doing that, it sets up kids learning this lesson that success is based on innate skill and you've either got it or you don't, mm-hmm. which is terrifying, right? You do give up on math because I'm not good at math. I'm not good at sports or whatever, and you just write it off as a category of experience because it's just one of those things that's not in your wheelhouse. You can't do it. And because of that, because the stakes become so high, we are protecting kids from failure. I wrote a piece called Losing is Good for You, not because I want people to, you know, embarrass kids and force them to experience mistakes and failures, but understand it's a process of learning. And if you're only letting kids, if you label them as successes because they're wonderful, they're special, it doesn't give them that room to make mistakes and learn from them.
Let's bring in Nikki from Nashville. Nikki, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a great subject. Fear of failure. I am looking back at my own life and many failed attempts at being an entrepreneur. I'm approaching 50 now, but I'm fascinated at the subject because I think we can also get caught in making failure a monument. I kind of say that failure has been my greatest success in self-reflection. I think reinvention plays a big role in it, and those little tastes of success, I think, are what help keep us motivated when we continually keep failing at effort. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, let me just ask you, Nikki, as you approach 50, do you consider yourself a failure or do you consider yourself a success or do you think the question doesn't actually apply?
Well, I consider myself actually a great success. There's professional success, personal success, you know, professional and personal failures and success. And I think that, you know, it's how you look at it. And I do think, too, sometimes I see children who are kind of examples of kids, you know, rejection can play a great deal in this and our ability to be able to handle rejection. I think rejection is, you know, something that needs to be talked about because I do think that plays a big role. And those who are able to handle rejection as
part of the journey towards success is kind of monumental and factors into
right.
how much we will succeed.
Let me bring,
as well as reinvention. I think that word reinvention is pretty important as well.
I want to bring your point, Nikki, to Amy Edmondson. Even though, Amy, you deal with organizations, in a sense, if you apply your organizational lenses to Nikki, it sounds to me as though she's actually kind of made the sort of adjustments and done the sorts of assessments that you're saying that organizations should do more often. She sounds pretty happy and to be at peace with where she is.
Yes. So in other words, I think she's thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And all of us need to understand the impact of novelty and uncertainty and complexity on the failures that we have. So I think we want to advise children, adults, employees, everyone to, as best they can, to avoid preventable failures. Right? There's a whole lot of great knowledge we have about how to achieve certain outcomes. Let's use it. So avoid the preventable failures. And anticipate and mitigate the fact that there's complexity, uncertainty, that certain things will go wrong simply because we couldn't anticipate all of the conditions, situations in advance. And then get down to the issue of fear of failure and help people overcome it to promote more intelligent failures, more of the kinds of failures that are the result of thoughtful experiments in new territory.
Let's bring in Connor from Atlanta. Connor, welcome to On Point.
Yes. Hey, John. I'm 40 years old. I don't believe that I've ever met anybody who hasn't failed at some aspect in their life. But the reason for my call is when I'm approached with a situation where I don't feel passionate about it, I don't have the drive within my heart to stay with something, that's usually when I know that it's time for me to move on or to quit or not to pursue something. And then even if there's something that seems like it's out of my grasp or it's an avenue that other people say, well, you know, you shouldn't go that route, if it's in my heart and I feel the passion and I feel drive and I can actually kind of see a vision within my head of that this is going to work, then that's when I pursue. And even if I it may fail at the beginnings, if that passion is still there and I still see the vision, then I stick with it until that's gone. And then once that vision is gone, then I pretty much know to move on.
And Connor, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wonder, are you good with that? You okay with how you're handling it?
I am good with that. I view it more as, in life, that if it's something that maybe I wanted but I just didn't have the heart to pursue it, or it is an avenue that I deem it shouldn't be for me and not for somebody else.
It's interesting. Again, thanks, Connor, for your call. Again, I think we're hearing from thoughtful people on this topic. And I'm wondering, Ashley Merriman, are there class differences? Are there gender differences in how people process success and failure?
Absolutely. I don't think so much in terms of class, although there are some socioeconomic responses to failure that are different. In times of stress, lower socioeconomic underprivileged communities sort of pull within and sort of look for support, whereas the more affluent communities actually broaden their network, looking for other people to help them work through situations. But I think what's probably the most striking and pertinent for this conversation about failure is the gender differences. In Top Dog, I wrote about the difference between playing to win and playing not to lose. And in playing to win, you're going for the success and what are the outcomes that are going to happen from it. Whereas playing not to lose isn't actually about winning. It's about preventing mistakes and disaster. And the research has actually shown that women are extremely good at calculating their odds of success, and men are really good at ignoring them.
Which is better?
And, well, you know, actually, I think it's a matter of timing. I think that women and research at Stanford University, Muriel Niederle, with experiments to political scientists, why more women don't run for office, that women are holding themselves out of too many competitions because they aren't willing to fail, they aren't learning to, you know, going for it, learning from the experience. They've got to get a guaranteed success. I wish more women would say, I'm just going to try it and see where this goes. And I think men actually would do a little bit better if they said, I've got this. And then they actually thought about those. So I think we can learn from all of it. And it's about timing.
All right.
To me,
go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, to me, playing to win is about entrepreneurial, setting visions and goals of what you're going to do. And then Playing Not to Lose is about fulfillment, making sure the promises that you've made, the products in your company, whatever it is, are what you intended them to be.
Well, here's a perfect setup to what I want to read from a listener on Facebook to finish up. Christopher Clymer Kurtz, this is your moment. You say, as part of the super small time, the Clymer Kurtz band, I could feel like an abject failure. My band has just 136 likes, including mine on Facebook, no interview ever on Fresh Air, and mostly non-paying gigs where many people who aren't very impressed with us don't stick around. But I try to look on the bright side. A small-scale, musical, non-career allows me to prioritize family and other stuff and just do music because I like it, not because my financial viability depends upon it. Thank you, Christopher Clymer Kurtz, for that closing thought. Thank you also to our guest. Amy Edmondson is professor of leadership and management at the Harvard Business School. Amy, thanks for joining us.
My
Ashley
pleasure.
Merriman, co-author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Thanks for being with us, Ashley.
Thanks.
And Peg Streep, author of Quitting, Why We Fear It and Why We Shouldn't in Life, Love, and Work. Peg Streep, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Amazing Grace on Broadway. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. I'd come back swinging. You tried to break me, but you see what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Stand a little.